we're going to do 2 hours today. The first hour will be the power hour. Second hour's general questions. Calls are starting to come in pretty heavy, but you've still got time. If you've got a question, a comment, a topic about anything, go ahead and press one on your phone. The sooner you do that, the better your odds of getting through. We're going to get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Today is the Power Hour. I've got the guys from Pittsburgh Power. Ethan and John are with me today, and this is the show where we take your calls and answer your questions about everything maintenance, engines, troubleshooting, diagnostics, upgrades, fuel mileage, power, you name it. We'll talk about it. All you have to do is pick up the phone and ask the question, and I'm going to bring in the guys from Pittsburgh Power. Hey, guys, welcome back.
Hi, Kevin.
How's it going, Kevin?
Good. Hey, John, I don't remember seeing that requisition for a day off last week. I don't think I approved that.
Sorry, I had a race car in Savannah, Georgia calling my name, so I had to go take care of it.
that's what I heard. How'd that go?
Really well, really, really well. The series that I engineer in has gone to a brand new chassis this year. It's gone from a tube space frame to a carbon fiber tub. And a whole bunch of other newness on it, paddle shifters and all sorts of neat things. So there's a lot to be done in here in the off season with them. So I'll be sneaking out here and there to do that. Not a whole lot. Maybe another trip or two this winter. That'll be it.
Now, that sounds like fun, though. Sounds like a challenge to get all that working right.
It's really cool. Yeah, it's all new. The systems are all new. So we've got to learn all the management for the systems and software and everything. And then see what the car wants for setup as well. So that's you always get back to the basics, too. It's a fun little problem to solve.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I see we're missing Bruce today. So next week I'll tell him. I don't remember seeing a requisition for a day off.
I'll give you a heads up next time. If I'm ever not going to be here on a Tuesday, and Tuesday's usually a day I'm normally here. It was really odd that I was away on a Tuesday. So,
Got it.
Yeah, I'll give you a heads up next time. I'll put in that requisition as soon as I find out. Interestingly, what happens is that business is so turbulent. You're dependent on some, wealthy kid's dad who's going to let him go racing. And then, they pay for these tests too. So it's interesting the way the whole thing works, and quite often happens last minute. So I received a plane ticket in my email on Saturday morning. That was when I found out I was leaving. So that was it. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I've got a couple things. We'll see what you guys have, and then we can get to some calls. I don't have anything major. I see fuel prices are working their way up. We're looks like we're over that dollar or $2.50 mark. So highest fuel prices since like October of 2015, I think. It'd be nice to see them get back up over $3.04 would be great for me.
We're creeping up on that here. I just spent $2.79 a gallon on my truck the other day. So.
Oh yeah, that's good to see. Good to see. I want to see more of that. We've talked a lot on this show about disruption. What's going to happen with technology and self-driving trucks. We've talked about Uber and Otto. There's another company that is very quietly changing transportation in a big way. And I think we're going to start hearing a lot more about them. And it's not a company that most people relate to transportation. It's a company we all know, but not many people think this is going to be a transportation disruptor. Any ideas who I'm talking about?
I'm at a loss. I don't know.
Amazon.
Oh, yeah, I did read something about that. You're right.
Yeah, Amazon. And, when I was at a conference a month or so ago, and they had a couple of analysts there, and the one guy was just so focused on Amazon. I think he spends his entire day studying what Amazon is doing, and they're a big, big company. So there's a lot to study, but yep. they are they are going to revolutionize trucking, I think. They're already starting to do it. Now they're talking about. So one of the things we've heard about as far as this big technology disruption is the Uberization of trucking. I'm so sick of hearing that. And I bet in the last 3 years, I have been approached by 30 companies and they all say the same thing. They walk up to me and they say, we're going to be the Uber of trucking. And I always say the same thing. Couldn't you be a little more original? You know, come on, really? The best you've got, you want to just copy somebody else. And then they look at me like a deer in the headlights because they think I'm supposed to be so excited that they believe they're going to be the Uber of trucking. And I've said there is not going to be an Uber of trucking. It's a totally different animal. It's a bad analogy. But the idea that somebody keeps trying to do, they keep trying to replace the broker with technology. And I heard that 25 years ago, and it still hasn't happened. And everybody who tries it fails. But Amazon has a real edge because Amazon is now controlling so much freight. And people don't realize that. And I think if anybody could pull this off and create technology that kind of goes around the broker, it might be Amazon. And then, you know, when you look at what they're doing with technology, who knows what they might come up with on that side. I know that doesn't have a ton to do with engines and what we normally talk about, but we've spent quite a bit of time on, you know, disruption and autonomous trucks. And I have a feeling that Amazon's going to have their hands in all of that stuff.
I could believe that. It's the whole app-based economy thing. And if they, you know, when the right app, even what I see from our guys here, that, you know, the Landstar guys, they've got a really nice app on their phone for finding freight. I mean, if that was just some general deal, or if, you know, all the Amazon's freight all of a sudden is available app based, if you're a trucker and you're somewhere and you can pop on the Amazon's app and find a load to go somewhere, I mean, that does change things quite a bit. And, yeah, you know, I use apps for everything. I mean, I do. It just, you know, I by my travel, usually whoever has the best app, Southwest's app for their flights is the best one, and Orbitz has the best one. You know, you're one click away from buying a flight, and that's the future, I believe, for everything.
You know, I agree. And Southwest, their app is awesome. So is that company, by the way. Well, I'll tell you how much we believe in the future of apps and programming. We are in the middle of an acquisition right now. We are buying our programming company. The company we've used for the last 8 years to do all of our website programming and our app programming, we're buying them. We spend so much money with them, and I just see a huge future in that kind of stuff. So the big advantage for us is we bring all of our own programming in-house. We'll get it done faster. We'll get it done cheaper. We'll get a lot more done, but we're also getting into the app market. For example, a lot of websites use Shopify if they have a store. Shopify is probably the most popular store platform now. But the thing with Shopify is it'll do 10,000 other things with apps. There's a whole marketplace of apps to make Shopify work better. And honestly, most of them just suck. We keep trying these apps and we find all this stuff wrong with it. And so we end up programming our own. Well, now what we're going to do is we're going to start marketing the apps we create. So you're right. I think there's a huge future in this kind of technology.
If you look at what we do, you know, you and I have talked about it before, but maybe an upgrade eventually to the with the scan gauge to an app based deal on a pad. You know, now that the Bluetooth technology with the with the data link has gotten a whole lot better, I think that that's something that's in the near future. And if you look at it from our aspect, I mean, I could do. You know, we could have a little Bruce in your pocket. You could have a problem with your truck and it could tell you something, or you could coach the driver as he's going. There's so much that we could do with those technologies that, yeah, I'm glad you bought that company. We'll make good use of that, I hope.
Yeah, so keep that in mind because we, it's a total of, with the owner, because he's now coming on board with total of 8 employees and a couple independent contractors that do some design and programming. So, yeah. Quite a bit. We actually,
congratulations.
Well, thank you. There's a company called Speed Gauges, and what they do is they kind of piggyback on top of the GPS tracking systems that are in trucks. So whether it's Qualcomm or PeopleNet or whoever it might be, this company Speed Gauges creates an overlay, almost an app kind of thing that works with the GPS tracking and provides all kinds of reporting and control back to the carrier. So things on speed and hard braking, and you know, they're taking all of the telemetrics and all the data that's available, and they're putting it into an app that really helps, you know, the carrier. And the company we're buying, the company that does all of our programming, does a ton of programming for this company as well. In fact, that's their second biggest customer, is Speed Gauges. So kind of an interesting wow. tie-in there as well.
Yeah, that's a perfect marriage there, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So we're excited about that. We'll be talking a lot more about that in the first quarter, and some of the new stuff we'll be able to do with that capability. So I'm sure we'll be talking to you guys about that as well. Let me get to a break. The music's playing. We'll come back. John and Ethan, we'll see if you guys have anything, and we'll get to some phone calls. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got the guys from Pittsburgh Power with me, Ethan and John. Anything you guys want to talk about, or should we get to some calls?
I don't know. You see anything new in the shop this week? I haven't.
This week's a little bit of a slower week. We've been playing catch up on a few projects. But now let's get some questions going.
All right. Let's do that. Let's start off in Pennsylvania. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, you guys, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, Kevin, you had me muted, but I was yelling Amazon.
you were correct, then.
Yeah, you're definitely right. And also, they're really close to kicking FedEx and UPS out of their game, both on the LTL side and the delivery side. They're doing their own deliveries.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing too, this is a topic I've been following for decades. Amazon hasn't been in this game very long, but they are doing a ton of their own deliveries now, and they're already facing lawsuits in multiple states about the whole independent contractor issue. This makes me crazy. They hire people just like FedEx has been doing. They fought this battle for years, so have other companies. They hire people. They're very clear up front. You are not an employee. This is a business. You own the equipment. You pay the expenses. Whatever you manage to, you know, create a profit, that's what you get paid. And these people agree to it. They do it. And then when they can't make enough money, they claim that they didn't realize they were, you know, a business, and they wonder why they're not making minimum wage. And then they want to sue. So now we have a bunch of attorneys getting rich over Amazon's issues now. I wish we could just get to a fair tax. We wouldn't have to argue about this anymore. It's kind of crazy. If you want to work in a business, work in a business, and there's no guarantee how much money you're going to make.
Yep.
That's interesting. I didn't realize there were also, they're just like the FedEx Home guys are all subcontractors, right? Is that how that works?
Yep.
The smaller FedEx structure,
yeah.
All little private businesses.
So when you look at FedEx, their divisions are all separated by colors. The overnight, the original FedEx is the purple and orange. Those guys are all employees, every one of them. Now, during the holidays, they may bring in some independent contractors just because it gets so busy. But the original FedEx is employees. Then FedEx bought RPS. That was who I was contracted to for years. And that's the purple and green. And they are 100% independent contractor. Every truck you see on the road pulling the doubles, every van you see FedEx Ground, those are all independent contractors, every one of them. Then they have FedEx Home Delivery, which is an even smaller truck. Some of those guys run around in little vans. They're all independent contractors as well. So they've been fighting this battle for years and years. There was one time that they just, it was kind of interesting. The IRS was fighting it, and all of a sudden FedEx just paid this monster penalty, like tens of millions of dollars, and the IRS went away. Nobody solved anything. Huh. It was almost like a payoff. We'll give you a bunch of money if you just go away.
No, it was a payoff. It wasn't like a payoff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so now Amazon gets to deal with that because they're doing the same thing. They are now building out networks of their own home delivery.
That's interesting. I'll come back to the Nikola thing because I really think it is going to happen. And they've integrated a system into their trucks already, a similar deal. So they're looking at it. It appeared to be the model that I'd read about from Amazon. I couldn't remember when you told me, but I did read that article a couple of weeks ago about the how they're going to do a basically an app-based load deal. And then if you watch the video and some of the stuff that Nikola's claiming to do, that's one of the things they're going to integrate into their trucks. So they're basically going to eliminate the Qualcomm system and have their own little system in there.
So here's where everybody has failed. We might as well stay on this topic because it's a good topic. Here's where everybody's failed. It's easy to build the platform. So here's a load. The load gets entered. The driver can look up loads. That's the easy part. And that's kind of the Uber model. And the reason it isn't working is because in order to put that load into the system, it's a lot of work. Each shipper has to go through all of their loads and enter them into a system. That's a lot of work in and of itself, and they don't have the people to do that. That's why they hire brokers in the first place. But once it's in the system, now drivers are going to see it, and guess what? They call, and they want to negotiate. So now you've got somebody on the phone trying to negotiate the price on the load. Once that happens, there's a ton of paperwork. There's insurance. There's, DOT certificate. There's all kinds of stuff that has to be verified and checked, and everybody's got to make sure all the compliance issues are in place. That it's a lot of work, and the shippers don't want to do that work. So they just hand their loads over to a broker, and the broker does all that for them. That's why shippers love brokers. Carriers hate brokers because they feel like they're taking a piece out of the profit.
Right. How does the U-Ship thing work? I know a lot of people buy big car parts and stuff on eBay, and I've had stuff brought to my shop that and just simply use the U-Ship website.
So
is that
U-Ship,
a website that acts as a broker? Are you familiar with that at all?
It is, and I'm very familiar with it. And the reason U-Ship has worked is because U-Ship tends to target either very, very small shippers or individuals who only ship once, maybe once in their whole lifetime they'll use U-Ship. You know, they have this big piece. They want to get it moved. They don't really, it's hard to deal with a trucking company as an individual. So U-Ship is kind of there more for the individual. You don't see big shippers going on and posting their stuff on U-Ship. You see very small companies that don't ship a lot of stuff, or you see individuals. So that's where now.
Yeah, that's why.
Go ahead.
That works well with the eBay model then. So if I want to sell a piece of equipment, if I want to sell a lathe I've got in my shop or something, I don't even think of calling a real shipper. I just use U-Ship.
Absolutely. That's the market that U-Ship filled in. And everybody looked at that and said, oh, look, it works. No, it doesn't. You don't have any big shippers going to U-Ship because they still would have to do all the work. and they would just rather hand it off to a broker and say, here, move all these loads for us. So somebody has to figure out how to make technology make that part of the transaction easier. And I haven't seen that happen yet. Now, the reason they're saying Amazon has probably a better chance of pulling this off than anybody is because Amazon now controls so much of the freight, all this inbound and outbound freight, and it's all their stuff. And they can build this internal system that will probably make posting and moving all of their own freight easy for them. And then I'm assuming they're going to grow into moving other people's freight as well. But so far, whether it's, you know, Nikola or Amazon, I haven't seen that piece of technology that's going to make this easy for the shipper. And until you do that, we're always right. going to have brokers.
So it'll just basically be a networking, a little assistance networking and moving it around. It's just communication.
Yeah. Yep. So we'll see. But it, the more I read about Amazon, the more I see that they may be the big disruptor in this market. So, Brian, you're still there. Sorry to take up all your time. You had a question. Go ahead.
That's okay. I had two things. Coolant temperature. I have a C12, and I think I might need a thermostat or thermostats. I'm told cats have two thermostats.
They do. Yeah, that should have two thermostats in it.
How does that work?
It's just for flow. I think they're right beside each other, right? It's like
they're side by side.
Side by side, and they heat up and move. What happens is they get sticky. Sometimes we've had instances where someone had done a coolant flush and not changed their thermostat, and all of a sudden the thermostat started hanging up afterwards. So, you know, if you've done anything, if you've changed your coolant or something, you could have some thermostats that are hanging up now.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I know it's cold in PA, but it's not that cold, and I'm running about 155.
Yeah, you probably ought to change them. They're probably not sealing off the whole way.
Okay. And then for Boost, I you're going to have to give Bruce hell because you know he's the one that knows this number, or maybe you guys know. a 2KS, a 2KS set at 410 should make how many pounds of Boost?
I have no idea. Bruce knows. He's got those numbers memorized. See if Ethan remembers.
I don't know that one.
You don't know that either. Yeah, that's all him. He's got that formula down.
How many pounds of Boost is it making?
The most I can get out of it, the normal, max is 22. Under the perfect conditions, I could squeeze 24. But I used to be able to
that's
get
that's about right. It should be about 18 per or something, right? I know the big cats, I think he calls it 18 horsepower per pound.
Hold that thought. We're going to come right back. We'll talk about that right after this. Yeah, Bruce, I think Bruce is hoarding the information on that calculation because he seems to be the only one that knows it. We'll be right back with more stuff after this. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Ethan and John with me from Pittsburgh Power, and we were talking with Brian. Brian, go ahead.
Okay. If I can jump back real quick to the thermostats, what temperature thermostats am I supposed to have?
We recommend the 180s normally. I think the CAT factory is 190 or 195, but that little bit of earlier open, especially if you're making horsepower, which maybe you aren't right now, but it seems to help keep it cool on the hills and so forth. But I'd go with the 180s. I'd put the 180 thermostats in it.
Okay. And then yeah, on the boost, everybody's telling me my truck's fine, and I've even had you guys look at it, but I guess even if it is making what it's supposed to, it's not making what it used to. And so I don't know.
Well, you got to get it in here.
Let
us put it on the dyno and check fuel pressure and check restriction and just make sure everything's healthy and working the way it should be.
Sounds like a plan. We're going to head off to Virginia. Bill, it's your turn. Welcome to the program.
How you doing? I just bought a truck, Kevin. I got an 01 Century with a 60 Series Detroit. And the horsepower on that is set at 500. What advantage would I get by getting a power box? Can that be used to go backwards in the horsepower to improve economy on the flats and stuff?
Well, I'll jump in and then I'll let Ethan and John, because no, you don't want to go backwards in horsepower, because the thing about horsepower is you only use as much as you need. So there's no point going backwards. When you're on the flat, you keep the boost nice and low. You're only using a minimum amount of horsepower anyway. We tend to find that increasing the horsepower gives us more flexibility in the hills to get better fuel economy. So that's my answer. Ethan and John, you guys can jump in.
We discussed that one time about making a box that cut horsepower, and it was unanimously voted back down. I don't remember who came up with the idea, but nobody really wanted to build it in the first place.
We do it with our multi-rating switch, though. We could cut you back a little bit with that, but that's a whole another story.
So would there be much of an advantage in getting a power box on an engine that's already set at 500, that the max they say is 550?
Oh, no, that's not the max.
I was going to wonder where that number came from. the advantage is, you know, factory rates it at the flywheel. A factory 500 Detroit on our dyno does about 430 on average at the wheels. I like seeing that number up around 5 to 550 at the wheels. It tends to find the best fuel mileage there.
Okay.
And
so
it just doesn't have to work as hard.
It'd be worth getting one then.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
All right. Yeah, I just bought this truck, you know, pulled it, been sitting 6 years, pulled it out of his yard. So it's getting a lot of things replaced at the Freightliner dealer at the moment.
Now, let me jump in there with another option as well on that engine. You know, you can either do the power box, which gives you a ton of flexibility, which I think is the real advantage behind the power box, or their tune on that engine is absolutely amazing. So with the tune, you get great fuel economy, great throttle response, tons of power. It runs great. It's a little simpler and less expensive than the power box. It doesn't give you the flexibility. So for me, when I had mine, nothing really changed much in my operation. So the tune was awesome. But if you have an operation where you spend some time in the Midwest, but then, you know, you go Denver to Southern California and you've got all those big pulls to make, or you get into really bad weather, beauty of the power box is you can turn the power up when you want it. Or if you're in really bad weather and slippery roads, you can turn it all the way off and go back to factory. So you got two really good options on that engine. You just got to decide which one fits your operation better.
All right. I got one more question for you. Just bought it, had it towed to the Freightliner dealer. I live in South Alabama, and it's going to be leased on and get its blaze plates from a company in Michigan. How do I get it from Alabama to Michigan?
You don't need to. You can do, the vehicle doesn't have to be in Michigan. All you're doing there is base plates, right?
Well, I mean, it'll get a base plates, and then, you know, they're going to put their stickers on the truck and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's really common, and there's no reason. Like, for example, when I had my fleet in Florida, the trucks were all in Florida. They were titled in either Ohio or Oklahoma because I avoided sales tax by titling in those two states. They had Illinois base plates because that's where FedEx base plated. And if I remember right, my IFTA was out of Missouri or somewhere weird. So it's very common to have multiple states involved in registration, base plates, IFTA permits, all that stuff.
So, I mean, I figured until you give that thing a DOT number and put a load behind it, it's not a commercial vehicle. So
correct.
Technically, I should be able to drive that like it's a car.
Yeah, you can.
Okay, because you know, in Alabama, they don't issue a temporary plate, even if you buy a car. You're legal to drive for 30 days on the bill of sale. Well, I asked the DOT officer in another state, he said, if you rolled in here like that, it might be in my jail for days.
Yeah, only because he's thinking about you pulling freight. You can't pull freight that way, but you can drive that vehicle around all you want, and you don't need to get it to the other state to get that base plate done. Let's, hey, Ethan and John.
Yes.
I've dealt with a lot of different states and licensing and all that stuff. Why don't all states do what he just mentioned there? Why do we even have a temporary tag system to begin with, other than for certain things? But when you buy a vehicle, why doesn't your bill of sale just count as a 30-day tag?
I have no idea. That's a good question. California does that, don't they? The tag stays with the car for its whole life, doesn't it?
That's different too. Yeah, there are some states that you know the owner keeps the plates, and some states where the plates stay with the vehicle. But I never thought about that. What a more efficient system to just do away with the whole issuing a temporary tag. Just say you have 30 days from your bill of sale date.
Right, your bill of sale works as your tag.
Yeah.
That'd be easy. That would make too much sense, Kevin. It just can't
that
work
makes
that
too
way.
Much sense. That's why that's not going to work. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. What's on your mind today?
Yep. A couple of questions and regarding the power box. I have a 94 L9000 Aeromax, and it's got a 3406E Caterpillar in it. I spoke to you about this truck before. Matter of fact, it's low miles, got just under 129,000 on it now as I'm rolling down the road. It's anemic on power. It's got a 355 horse 3406E in it, and I do high fives, low sixes for fuel economy, but I think I could do a fair amount better if I had more power, because when I'm coming to hills, I mean, I've got my foot stuffed in that thing. I'm looking at my scan gauge. I'm watching those numbers fall, just trying to make these hills, where if I had a little bit more power, I think I could, you know, be able to manage my fuel savings significantly better. Would the power box allow me that flexibility in this particular application?
On that one, for sure. Yeah, the cats respond very well to the power box. That would be a huge improvement to your truck, probably more so than our previous caller even. Yep.
Well, I was told that this 355 horse 3406E was a very different configuration due to its cam and the dome of the pistons, et cetera, that it was really limited by the cat dealer when I was looking to turn this thing up. You know, a year ago or 2 years ago when we first got this truck.
The cat dealer is always going to go by the books there. I've turned a few up, and you can't go crazy. I mean, that's not a, you know, 1,000 horsepower machine there. But if you take it to 500, you've got no issues there.
Oh, I was thinking about 400.
Yeah, I've taken them to 5 before.
But we could probably safely get you to 5 or 550 even. Yeah, that wouldn't be a problem at all.
But you're not making an 800 horsepower monster out of it.
Yeah, and those 3406Ds respond really well to the power box. You'll be amazed.
Is that something I could do myself, or is that something I need to bring to you guys?
You could do that yourself in about 2 hours. It's easy.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time. Merry Christmas to you all.
All right. Merry Christmas. We're going to get to a break. We'll be right back with more stuff right after this. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got John and Ethan with me from Pittsburgh Power. We're going to get back to your calls in a second. John, you know, this is the one show I do a week where I don't have to really participate 100%. Because when I hear that the question's kind of for you guys, and I listen with half my brain, and sometimes I try to catch up on some of my reading at the same time. I was just scrolling through an article. This is really interesting, and you and I have talked about this a lot. So they did a survey. They asked truck drivers how long they thought it would be before autonomous vehicles would replace them. The answer was like 40 years. That's what truck drivers think.
Oh.
Then they went and asked a bunch of people from Silicon Valley, technology people. You know what their answer was? Three.
It's going to be like 4 years. Three? Okay.
They said three. Yeah. What a difference.
Well, I'm thinking there will be a substantial amount of them within 10. I don't know if it'll be a significant jab to the, you know, significant cut to the market for drivers, to the drivers. I don't think it's going to cost that many jobs in 10 years, but I think we will be seeing them in 10 years doing certain jobs. That's my opinion.
Yeah. Some of the technology people said 3 years, there will be significant numbers of autonomous vehicles. And the rest of them said, we'll just say we're going to measure it in years, not decades.
Wow. That's going to be interesting. I find it all really exciting. I really do. That's going to be a fun industry to work in even then. There'll be other jobs around, that there'll be things that we need to learn how to repair and work with. And yeah, I think it's, I find it all pretty exciting.
Yeah. And the message I'm trying to get across, I mean, I'm taking a lot of heat. Every time I talk about this, people, you would think that I'm the one responsible for it. I'm just reporting the news here. Don't shoot the messenger. But my point, the reason I bring it up is there still is going to be a huge need for drivers. The problem is you're going to have to, I would not feel comfortable unless I put myself in the top one third. You know, I either had, you know, really good skills or specialized skills, or I think the market for really good owner operators is still got a very, very long life, because the fleets are going to be the first to move to this technology, or we're going to see whole new players. Somebody like Amazon is going to come in with all autonomous trucks right off the bat. Somebody yep. like that is going to disrupt the industry. It's not necessarily going to be Swift or US Express or any of those companies. In fact, it's probably not right. going to be companies. It's going to be somebody we don't see. But in this transition, which the transition will take decades, there are going to be tons of opportunities for people who are paying attention and understand where those are. That's why I keep bringing it up, so that we stay on top of this and you don't wake up one morning and say, oh, look, I don't have a job anymore.
But you nailed it with paying attention. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to some phone calls. Let's go to Wisconsin. Jack, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I have a question for Power Guys. It's, I got an N14, and I've got dual thermostats in it. And I was just wondering, I have been told that to get maximum burning of your diesel, you should be running your thermostats like 192 to 194. Is that true, or is that just some kind of wives' tale?
That's pretty specific range there, I'd say. I've heard 195 thermostats are probably best for efficiency, but the problem with that is, and depending on where you run and how you run, is keeping it cool sometimes. If you've got that extra heat energy in there that you're trying to get out, if you're starting from 195 as opposed to starting from 180, you may have trouble keeping it cool. So that's why we recommend the 180s, especially for our performance-minded guys. But there is some truth to that. Like I've always been told, and you know, I've read on about it, the efficient burn happens with about 195 degree water temperature. And there are so many factors that go into that, though. We've discussed the Evans coolant here and stuff. So if you've got Evans coolant, you're showing 195 on your gauges while you're actually cooler inside than you would be with others. And it's a complicated science. So I think it depends on where and how you run and the kind of horsepower you're making as to if you get away with the 195s, run them. If you can't keep it cool on the 195s, go to the 180s.
Okay. And the other question is, now this is the red top, and I talked to Bruce. He's gonna, or you guys are gonna rebuild it for me probably in the spring. And he said something about the number on it. I thought he said C2124, and I've looked all over this motor and I can't find any number like that. I mean, what is that?
That he's talking about your CPL number. It's a control parts list, it stands for, which is Cummins code number for the arrangement of parts that are inside of that engine. So somewhere on the tag, it'll say CPL, and it'll be, like you said, like 2124. I don't know off the top of my head all the different N14 CPLs. But that CPL tells you the timing it's built with, the compression ratio it's built with, the fuel curve, the flow of the injector. It's a whole package. And that explains to, you know, and then we'll know the capabilities of that engine if we were to turn it up or what we're to do with it afterwards by knowing the CPL. But somewhere, if your tag is still on there right in front of your accessory drive on the side of the block, there should be a silver and red tag. And somewhere on there, there's a box that says CPL, and it'll have a four-digit number in it.
Oh, okay. If not, we can look it up with the engine serial number.
If not, we can look it up by the engine serial number, yeah.
Okay, now, I know it's a 460 horse, and everybody that has had N14 is telling me that I don't want to turn it up because I will lose my fuel economy. Now, what is that all about?
That's a wives' tale there.
Okay. Yeah, because right now I'm getting 7.72 with it. Depending, you know, I run pretty much Minnesota to Alabama, and you know, I'm 55 or 58 miles an hour. If I'm in a hurry at 62, but okay.
Right.
Okay, well, you asked my questions, and everybody have a Merry Christmas.
All right, you too.
All right, we're going to jump down to this question because I want to know the answer to this one too. We're off to Alabama. Les, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I have an uncle who is a nuclear physicist who retired from the Department of Energy. Matter of fact, he actually worked on a 5-kiloton test. And I asked him about the EMPs, and he said the answer is shielding and grounding. So if you can shield the electronics, i.e. the Faraday cage, and provide grounding, it's possible to protect the electronic components.
John?
There it is. That's have the answer.
Sounds right.
I agree. Yeah, that should cover it.
Well, now somebody's got to build the kit.
And he actually said, with the exception of the windows and the door seals, that a truck body would actually make a pretty decent Faraday cage.
Interesting.
I'm sure it would. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. You just got to give it the right charge somehow, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yep.
So,
we'll get to work on that force field. Yep.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. There we go. Let's go to California. Corbin, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. I was wondering about using lighter weight oil in places like the transmission and differential. I'm already doing it in the trailer. I'm running the Shell Rotella 1540, the synthetic in the bearings, and that seems to work fine. I was wondering where else I could go to kind of free up some bowing resistance.
I'll jump in here, and then I'll bet John's going to have something to add on the oil side. You know, what we found is get away with lighter oils in the axles, like trailer axles in the transmission. You've got to be very careful in the differentials because of all the force. So they have some different additives and different requirements in the differentials. And the goal here, anytime we're trying to use lighter oils, we're trying to reduce that parasitic drag from the oil itself. So the balance is always find the lightest oil you can use without compromising the component. So we want to get all the life we can out of the component, but we want to use a lighter oil. John, you got about 30 seconds to add to that.
You nailed it. That's fine. Be careful in the diffs. You do need something that will stand up to the differential. Some sort of a hypoid oil has got to be in there. But they've got some really nice lightweight stuff out there now. I'm fond of a product called Redline. I use Redline oils a lot in racing. And they've got some real lightweight stuff if you want to play around with their product. They're not in the truck industry, but they'd work just fine. But, yeah, as light as you could possibly go until you, you know, and I don't know how you monitor it unless you watch heat on your hubs and things like that. I don't know how you'd see when you've gone too far. This is something that's easy for us in racing because we'll go out and break something and know, well, that the oil is a little bit too light.
There we go. We're all up time. Yeah. We'll see you next time. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks. And thanks to John and Ethan from Pittsburgh Power. And we're going to go ahead and get started on a second hour of general questions. So here we go. Let me take a look and see how many we have, see if we have any room. Looks like we've got lots and lots of calls. So we're just going to go ahead and get started. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your own authority. The list goes on and on. We'll talk about anything. You just pick up the phone and give us a call. Speaking of calls, I think we're going to jump right into them tonight. We've got a bunch. Let's head off to Missouri. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Kevin?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Hello. Hey, what's up? Yeah, I was listening to you talk about the South Dakota getting your license and everything up there. I'm real familiar with that process up there. But there's a downside that they have to kind of consider is when you get your driver's license and you want to tell them basically you're living in your truck, there's two things they need to keep in mind. One, you have to sign an affidavit there saying that you do not have a residence anywhere else. And number two, you're looking at a potential issue with getting your per diem because you know the purpose of the per diem. That's the amount of money you get when you're out on the road away from home. So you give all that up. So if you have a driver's license with that.
Yeah. Yep. But here's the thing. Both of those are easy to get around. One, that affidavit is not necessary, saying you don't have a residence somewhere else. I know they do that to protect themselves in South Dakota. That's not necessary. There is no law that says I can't have a residence in 32 states if I want.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing would ever stop me from having multiple residents. At one point, I had a business and a residence in Florida, a residence in Ohio, a residence in Oregon, and I was on the road 6 months out of the year in an RV. So now tell me, what state am I a resident of in that scenario?
Well, what happens here, being in Missouri is kind of strange. In fact, I tried to get my plates up there and getting the apportion tags. You know, South Dakota says, you know, you have to supply us with either a electric bill, property where you live, actually live, you know, residence. But like Missouri, I'll give you an example. We had a company that was here in Kansas City set up a trucking operation in Florida, and Missouri went right after it. he had a house here and a business in Florida, and they went after him. And these states now, I mean, I don't know technology-wise how they're tracking people down, but, you know, they're chasing that money, Kevin, pretty hard.
No, and they've always done that, but there are lots of ways around it. And again, what it comes back to, you know, like I said, like South Dakota saying you have to sign an affidavit saying you don't have a residence anywhere else. No, you don't. I mean, this company might require that, but there's, like I said, there are no laws that stop us from having multiple residents in as many states as we want, and then we choose which state we claim as our home because the IRS says you have to. The IRS says you have to tell us where you file your state taxes. That's the only reason, right. But we have to claim a state of residence, and lots of people own properties in multiple states. So, you know, there's no clear cut rules anywhere about what makes a state your home residence. So, you know, this is kind of stuff where there are no clear rules. One, you'll have one state, like you said, going after somebody because they've done something in another state. That kind of stuff happens all the time. But for drivers who spend a lot of time on the road and somebody who wants to say, look, I'm, you know, going to give up my house, put my stuff in storage, and I'm going to stay in the truck. The thing that I tell them is you can do that. You just don't ever tell the IRS. You always claim that there is a residence somewhere. I don't care if you're paying, you know, somebody in your family $25 a month just to sleep in a bed when you're in that state, whatever. We determine right. A residence somewhere because of the per diem. Because if you live in your truck, then you don't qualify for any per diem because you're never away from home.
All right. Yep. I'm fixing to get my authority. I'm trying to line all this stuff up. And, you know, I'm looking at also bank-wise, if I'm wanting to get a loan or grow my business, you know, it's going to look kind of funky if I got some sort of P.O. box scattered out. It doesn't look really – you tell me, does it look really too stable if I do something like that?
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Again, banks don't care much about that. Now, if you were borderline on a lot of other things, they might consider it an issue. But if I go in with good assets, good credit, you know, I've got profit and loss statements, my business, I have all my accounting in order, then the bank could care less about that other stuff. You know, the bank is more afraid of financing the truck than anything because the truck is what they call rolling stock. And if they have to repossess it, it can be very hard to find. But having a P.O. box is not a big deal. I have a P.O. box just because where I live, they don't deliver mail. So I have a P.O. box. It's not a big deal. Let's go to Minnesota. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I got two questions for you on the health side.
All right.
My wife's hair is shedding quite a bit, and she's also lost her gallbladder. I know, and not having your gallbladder, you get cracked feet. I was wondering if that also ties into the shedding of hair.
It does in a little more roundabout way. And I'll tell you what's going on there, and this is fairly common. This is another sign of adrenal fatigue. There are lots of signs of adrenal fatigue, and we're getting ready to do a whole protocol and training on adrenal fatigue because we're seeing so many people suffering from this now. So adrenal fatigue can get a little complicated. It has a lot to do with lifestyle. This is one of those areas where lifestyle can be even more important than diet, but diet is playing a factor and her lack of gallbladder is playing a factor. And I'll kind of go through the sequence of what's happening. The adrenal glands control a lot of stuff that goes on in our body. The adrenals are really important, and the adrenals function and produce hormones, over 50 of them. And then the hormones have control over all these other things. So the hair loss is part of this. But what happens is in order to produce hormones, we need lots of the fat-soluble cofactors. So if you are not digesting fats properly, you're not going to build the hormones you need, and the adrenals are going to suffer. if you combine that with kind of a high stress lifestyle or somebody who doesn't handle stress very well, then you really have adrenal issues. So my guess is if we were to do an evaluation on her runner through the NutriQ, we would come up scoring very high on adrenals.
Okay. I was just kind of wondering if those two were tied in with each other. My other question is, my other question is cold feet. I've been outside working in cooler weather up here in northern Minnesota, and my feet seem to get a lot colder than my buddy that I'm working with sooner, and he said it's possibly blood flow. Does that sound right to you? And if so, how do I remedy that?
That's always been the thought, that it was low blood flow, and that's just not true. There can be some circulation issues, but even if there is, that's the symptom. So we wouldn't address the blood flow itself. That's the symptom. We would find out why. But again, we come back to, it's much more likely that you've got low thyroid function rather than poor blood flow. So the thyroid function has a lot to do with cold and not being able to regulate body temperature as well, cold hands, cold feet, cold extremities, being sensitive to both heat and cold. Those are all issues of thyroid. And the adrenals could have some something going on there as well. And like I say, it's very, very common in today's world to see these thyroid and adrenal issues.
Okay, that answered my question. Gives me somewhere to research and look into. Thank you very much for your time, and have a happy holidays.
You too. Merry Christmas. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Louisiana. Mike, welcome to the program. Mike, are you with me? Mike, here's what we're going to do. The music just started playing, so I'm going to put you back on hold. I'm going to see if we've still got that line there, and I'm going to come back to you right after the break and see if you're there. So stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff right after this. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to try Mike one more time in Louisiana. Mike, are you with us? Doesn't look like it. Mike?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. All right.
Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
Very good. I got a Sirius Radio in 2005, and I've been listening to you off and on ever since then.
Well, thank you.
And I really do enjoy the show. And you've done, man, when you first started, I think a few people were scared to call because you were pretty hard on them when they called in and wanted to be an owner-operator. But the show's really come out really good, Kevin. I really enjoy it.
Thank you.
I had a question about rates. I've been an owner-operator for about 5 years, and I'm ready to explore everything I can do possibly about getting my own authority and those kind of things and buying a trader. But man, I can't find a way to study rates. Everywhere I go, they want a DOT number, or they're not even interested. I can't get on any load boards. The people I'm leased to, they're not even excited at all about that, you know. So
How do you study rates? How do you study rates in the position I'm in?
This is a good question, and I've even worked with both DAT and now truckstop.com. One of the things, I completely understand why they have to have the DOT number in order to give access. There's a lot of reasons they have to do that, and I get it. What I've asked them to do is if they could create like dummy accounts. So access to, so here's, instead of giving somebody like you access to the current load board, give them access to what was on the load board a month ago just to practice. So they're not even live loads anymore. Right. You can go in and see them, and you can go back and look at historical data. And they love the idea. It's just a matter of, it's like every company, you know, there's cost there, there's programming, there's time, everybody's busy. So that's the possible solution to what you're facing, because I feel the same way. I would love for people to be able to study rates for as long as they wanted before they go get their own authority. But right now, it's just not possible. All the load boards do require you to have that number to even get an account and get access. So it's one of those things. I wish we had another alternative. Right now, we just don't. So you need to be studying business as much as possible. And then as soon as you get that number, you get in the load boards and you just commit to spending as much time as you can in there once you have access. Or the other possibility, find a friend who has access and get their login.
Well, I thought about trying to snuggle up to somebody that's doing that and it has an active DOT number and whatnot, but yeah. I don't really have any friends that are truckers.
Yeah, well,
kind of weird, I guess. But
no, I get it. But you may have to make some. You know, join a group on Facebook with, you know, there's, we have Trucking with Authority and lots of groups like that where I'm sure somebody, you know, once you got to know them, you would share a login so you can go in. It's definitely something you want to get good at, but it's also something that, here's what happens. I know guys that have had their own authority for 20 years and they never bother to look at rates or lanes. They have load board subscriptions. All they do is go in, look up a load, call, and that's it. They're not looking at the negotiation tools. They're not looking at any of that stuff. So even if you can't do it ahead of time, if you just commit that once you are in that position, you have access, you're going to spend time every week in there. And if you do that, that still moves you up into the top 5% pretty quickly, because very, very few people spend any time doing that work.
Okay. Okay. Well, that pretty well answers it. Once again, I enjoy your show and I appreciate your help.
Thank you. Let's go to Illinois. Wes, welcome to the program.
Yes. Good afternoon. The other host, a couple of shows back, Bruce was talking about retaining heat in the system around the turbo and that. It was because of the way their manifold works. I was wondering how, if it would be cost effective, like say you drop a head gasket and you have to, you've got the head off already for that. And would it, having that done to the exhaust ports, be a help? Yeah.
You mean in the head itself, not the manifold, but the in the head itself porting it?
Maybe some porting, but then that ceramic coating like they're doing with the exhaust manifold. You know, instead of just the manifold, start right at the valve with that process.
You know, that there may be something there. I that would have been, and I know you called for the power hour and we just couldn't get to everybody in time. That would have been a great question for John. John would probably know that one better than anybody. What I'm thinking, and I hadn't thought about this before, so I'm kind of thinking off the top of my head, in a situation where you're talking about where you've already got the head off, maybe we're doing an in-frame, it might be something to look at. Otherwise, I think that it would be way too expensive to just go in and do it for the little bit of benefit we have. There's not a tremendous amount of surface there. You know, we're not talking about a very long distance that those gases are traveling.
Yeah.
So there just might not be enough to gain. Whereas the manifold, you know, there's quite a bit of flow surface there. So we're really making a pretty big improvement. But that's just a guess off the top of my head that it might just be too expensive and we might not get a big enough gain.
And then about the downpipe and like that with that header wrap stuff and around the turbos, they have those things. I know I've seen them in the Summit Racing catalog, that material that's heat resistant to a couple of thousand degrees.
Yeah, Pittsburgh Power sells that. They call them turbo blankets and exhaust wrap. So we actually insulate all of those components to keep the heat in. And the idea is the hotter we keep that gas, the lighter it is and the faster it flows. So, I like the question on, you know, the heads. I think I'll write that down and try to remember to ask John that one next week, or maybe I'll send him an email. Let's go to Colorado. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What can I help you with today?
We were going to look at a oil test report.
Okay. This is a 5.9 liter Cummins, correct?
Yeah, it's in a Dodge pickup.
Okay. It's a really, really clean sample. I don't look at a lot of oil samples on these smaller engines, but really clean. I mean, we have no fuel dilution, no soot whatsoever. Viscosity's perfect. Base is right where it should be. No oxidation, no nitration, no sodium or potassium. Silicon numbers are low and wear metals are almost non-existent. So looks like you've got a nice healthy engine there.
So 15 for oxidation, does it really mean anything?
Oh no, that's very, very low. I mean, that's still registering zero on the severity chart. That the oil gets oxidized that much just by opening the bottle.
Okay. The aluminum and lead, that's still nothing, concern?
Nope, those numbers are so low. When you look at lead at 5, I bet there are times we could probably open a bottle of oil, pour it into a sample cup, and come up with these numbers on clean oil that's never even been in an engine. I mean, they're always going to be traces, and that's all these are. Your numbers are just traces of wear metals. They're very, very low.
Okay, well, you see that there's only 5,000 miles on the oil, and I didn't find a place on the paper to send it in for the capacity, and it only holds 11 quarts.
Well, and that's why you're going to have much lower drain intervals. So on the smaller the capacity, the more often you would typically change the oil, unless you have a bypass filtration system. So that's why, even though it's only 5,000 miles, I usually look at samples with 20,000 miles, but those are much bigger engines. So this is... You could always keep going, go to 10,000 and do a sample and see what your sample looks like. And that's one of the ways to determine how long you could run this oil. I've got to get to a break. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. We're off to Kansas. David, welcome to the program. David, are you with me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
Okay. I got a question, and I was kind of hoping I'd have got in with the Pittsburgh Power Boys, but let's see what we can do. I found a 14-liter Detroit pre-GR, but it was set up on a oil field type of trailer that they use for, like, fracking and stuff like that. So
right.
The settings and everything, it's an industrial use setup. Well, the thing's only got, we figured the hours on it, it's got 500 hours on it. Roughly, I'd figure that's about 30,000 miles. What would you think about running those things on a highway? I mean, I got one truck that's getting ready for an overhaul, and I was thinking about just putting that in for, I can pick it up for about 11 grand, and I'd have
do
some changing as far as the bell housing and the oil pan, stuff like that, just to make it a little bit lighter. But do you think with the settings that it would be good for, you know, to go down the highway, that it'd be efficient?
I would buy that engine in a heartbeat.
Okay.
That is an awesome engine. They're fairly rare. I know of one right now being used, a pre-emission 14 liter, which is pretty rare. They, in order to be a pre-emission 14 liter, they were either built for military or industrial, because when the 14 liter came out, we were already in the emission requirements. In fact, they built the 14 liter because of the emission requirements. So the only way to get one non-emission or pre-emission was industrial or military. I have personally known of two of these. I knew of a guy who bought an industrial, put it in a truck, was getting amazing fuel economy, and it was trouble-free. And Pittsburgh Power did one where they managed to buy one of these engines, and I don't remember what it was built for. But they put it in a truck, and we still talk to those people pretty regular, and they've had great results with theirs. If you can get an engine with that low of hours at that price, I would be all over that thing.
Okay. All right. That's kind of what I figured. I actually have a truck with the 14 liter. And it's an amazing motor. I mean, for as big as it is and as much horsepower as it is, it gets, I mean, I'm over 7 and I haven't done anything on it, just consistent over 7. And, I mean, the power on it is great. I just didn't know if this other one, because this other one's rated at 665 horsepower, I mean, stock. No,
right.
No bigger turbo, no nothing extra. That's straight out of the box. And,
yeah. So now what I would do is I would call Pittsburgh Power. I know you were hoping to talk to them, but they would have given you probably the same answer on the air as I did. But you could also get the engine serial number before you call them. They can do some research, find out what kind of settings are in there, what kind of components are on there, and they'll be able to tell you exactly what you should be doing to make that, you know, really efficient on road. But unless it's some really weird build, I've seen the industrial and the military builds, and I would be all over that, especially at that price. Let's go to New Mexico. Al, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Good. What can I help you with today?
Can you hear me? Yeah, I'm calling. I'm driving from Iowa down here to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And when I was going through Kansas City, I have a scan gauge. My engine light came on, and I looked at my scan gauge and looked up the code. I had one code in there, and the ID was 29. And I looked that up on my phone, Google, and it said that it was a PTO throttle signal. You have any idea what that is?
I don't. And the problem with most codes is many time codes are either what we call ghost codes or they're kind of meaningless junk codes. And
Oh, really?
There's lots of codes that are just kind of meaningless. They're not going to help much at all. Now, this is another good question. And I know you also called for the power hour, but we get so many questions, we don't always get to them. Sometimes they can help with the codes. The engineers over at Pittsburgh Power work in this stuff every day, so they have a really good understanding of what codes are worth looking at, what codes are just, you know, kind of junk or garbage. And sometimes a code can give you partial information on where to start looking.
Mind if I call them?
Oh, no, I would give them a call. They do that kind of stuff all the time. Now, I will say, let me just throw this in because this is a good time to address this. You know, we really value our partnership with Pittsburgh Power. They take time out of their week. Many times three people from that company come on and join us. I use them a lot for research and questions. And because they're on the air, they get people all the time call them and just want to ask a question. They do that, and they give a lot back to the industry. I would also want people to consider use their services as often as you can. If we're going to use them as a research and take up all their time and ask all these questions, you know, also give a little back. So if you're going to buy a muffler, don't go try to save $30 on that muffler somewhere else. Get it from them. You know, get the crankshaft damper from them. Use them as much as possible because they do give a tremendous amount back to the industry, and they certainly give a lot to our show and our listeners here. Let's go to... We're going to head back to the phones. We're going to go to Indiana. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hello. How you doing?
What's on your mind today?
Well, as you were just saying, you do a lot of work with Pittsburgh Power. And I just wanted to quickly ask on the Pittsburgh Power side, how much is, like, if I wanted their whole workup for 12-7, what would I be looking at, kind of as a base price?
Do you mean something like having an out of frame rebuild done?
No, like all their additives, their power kit and all that stuff.
Okay, so I could kind of run through and start to give you a general idea. I don't stay on top of pricing, but I have some rough ideas. So if you were to pull in, and we're not talking about rebuild, we're talking about what kind of bolt-on modifications could they do. So they carry most of the stuff we talk about. So Fleet air filter, you're looking at $300 or $400 on a Fleet air filter. Fast fuel system installed, probably close to $2,000, somewhere in that range. OPS installed, probably looking at $1,000 or $1,200. You could do the ported and polished manifold, probably again, $1,500 on that. Tuning in the $1,500 range, power box. If you wanted a power box instead of tuning, probably more like $2,500. What else could they do?
That's gonna be most of it.
Yeah, I mean, you could pull into Pittsburgh Power and rack up, you know, a $6,000 or $7,000 bill with upgrades and modifications.
Oh, I'm sure you can.
But You would also be looking at over a mile per gallon in fuel economy gains. So you're still looking at paying off all of that stuff in less than a year.
Oh, yeah, easily.
Yeah.
But that's actually kind of one of the big reasons I called, because I have an issue with my truck, and I've taken it to the mechanics, and they cannot figure it out. I gave it to them for a whole week. They couldn't figure it out.
What's the issue?
I've got a vibration, and I think it's engine-related, because it really vibrates really hard when you're trying to pull up a hill or accelerating from a stop. Anytime the engine is under stress, it vibrates real bad. To the point where you can't even hear anything inside the cab but the vibrations.
So how many miles are on it?
1.353 mil.
Has the crankshaft damper ever been replaced?
The engine was actually completely rebuilt 3 years ago.
Well, hold that thought, because I'll guarantee you they didn't replace the crankshaft damper. And yours is clearly worn out. You should be coming up on your third replacement. That crankshaft damper should be replaced every 500,000 miles. I am 95% sure that yours is original, and that's where I'd start. But I have a couple other ideas for you, so hold on. We'll get to those right after this break. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. We're down to the final segment. So, Robert, I would start there, because clearly that crankshaft damper needs to be replaced. I would add the balancer from Pittsburgh Power. They're the only ones that have that. They invented it. So I would add that. There still may be some other issues. And the two that I would look at fuel flow. Many times when we see an engine vibrate under, when it's trying to develop a lot of power and it starts vibrating, many times it's fuel flow. So we could look at injector.
That's my first thought.
Yeah, that's very common.
I've noticed a big drop in fuel economy.
Yeah, so Pittsburgh Power could diagnose that on the dyno pretty quickly. The other thing I've seen that a lot of people fail to think about, sometimes it's a clutch surface. So as that engine's trying to develop a lot of torque, if the clutch isn't engaging as well as it should, we can get some hop or vibration coming out of a clutch. Sometimes just needs resurface, sometimes new clutch, but a lot of times people fail to look there, and I've seen that cause what you're talking about as well.
Okay, because it's just been scaring me, you know. I don't like to drive this truck and feel like things are falling apart on me, you know.
Yeah, and I would certainly get that taken care of, because it is going to cause other problems. You'll have brackets start breaking. You put a lot of stress on the driveline, on U-joints, on all of that. So, you know, your best bet, if you could get it to Pittsburgh Power, I would certainly do that. They could diagnose this pretty quick, but I would start with those. Let's go to North Carolina. Steve, welcome to the program.
Merry Christmas, Kevin.
Merry Christmas. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, I've got a couple of things. I am going to be LLCing, and I was going to see a lawyer while I was home this week. But I went online with North Carolina, and I saw that it's a very simple process. They actually have a PDF where you actually type everything into it, then you print it out and send them $125. Actually, on your whatever you decide your name is, every year you you search your name and you click online and do you just do your annual report online. Is there anything else other than payroll that you have to do other than that? I don't see any reason for me to go hire a lawyer and pay $500 or $600 to pay $125 and get it done. And I can do it, and I have an accounting background, so the payroll's no problem. Is there anything else I'm missing on that?
No, there really isn't. There are people who will say you should never form a corporation or an LLC without an attorney because of all the things that could go wrong. But typically, those are businesses that are going to be more complicated. They're getting into areas of sales tax and selling across state lines and, you know, multiple owners. And then you clearly want an attorney. But honestly, for owner operators that we're talking fairly small companies, not very complicated, I have yet to ever see an issue that would have mattered. So you can go do it yourself this way.
Okay. Well, I'll just not do the lawyer thing because it was going to be $500 and he was going to get $375 and take $125 of it, send my paperwork in, which I'd have to fill out with him anyhow. So, I mean, it makes it very simple. All right. And I reckon either TurboTax or Quicken probably have the cheapest payroll. So I'm only going to pay myself once a month. So I should have minimal charges on that because I want to do it correctly so it actually sends in all my payroll taxes. Yeah, where I don't have to do that manually. I think the IRS probably require it to be done electronically these days. So is one of them pretty well the least expensive on the payroll?
Believe it or not, the two you mentioned, and all of these are from the same company, TurboTax, Quicken, they're all for do it. Neither one of those do payroll. What you need is QuickBooks.
QuickBooks, okay. Okay, well,
And I will tell you, I have used QuickBooks payroll service for the last 20 years, one of my favorites. I think they have an awesome payroll service. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I used QuickBooks from the 80s through to early 2000s. I did books for another business, and I love QuickBooks. I haven't used it in a number of years, but I did love that. The only other question I have is on the NutriQ, I signed up and got my personal information in there. I got one email about like three concerns we have. Are we going to get a survey that we're going to fill out like a long survey? I haven't received anything else other than an email, and I haven't had time to respond to it yet. But about three concerns you have. Are we supposed to get a survey once we sign up?
You are. You should have received a link that would take you to the NutriQ questionnaire, which is very in-depth. I mean, it goes through a lot of questions.
Okay. I need
over 100 questions.
Because once I put my personal information in, I went next, and it ended. I never saw a survey.
Let me put you on hold so we can look up your account and see where it might be in the process. I will tell you, for the free NutriQ evaluations that we're doing, we are swamped. We have hundreds of them. So it's possible you're still in the system, but I want to make sure that we check that out. So I'll have Bridget pick up. And we will see, we'll track that down and see where you are in the process. Let's go to Florida. Wes, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello, is this me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, this is Wes in Florida. I just had a little pet peeve. I know everybody else the last 2 years has been noticing all these towers that's been going up and down the interstate. It's just disgusting. Don't remember voting on them. Don't remember seeing anything of what they're really about. Don't remember seeing anything about how our taxpayer money has been used for these things. And I was wondering if there's a connection between them, possibly the autonomous truck technologies that's rolling down the pipe here and these towers. And if there's anything we could do to maybe sign a petition against them, get them maybe stopped. I mean, they're about completed, it seems like. They're about every quarter mile. If you're out here, you know what they are. You know what's going on.
Yeah, you know, there's a ton of towers that are being put up. Are you talking about cell phone towers, or are you talking about some other kind of tower?
No, this is a new technology, but they run off, I mean, they're not cell phone towers. They're poles with some sort of a imaging device, sort of similar, look like an x-ray type thing. It's like an ear, look like some sort of an ear. And then it has a camera on top of them, and they're going up every quarter mile. Yeah, I mean, they've about got the whole Southeast networked. I mean, that's where I run mostly. And I mean, like, I just left Tallahassee, and, you know, they did Tallahassee a few months ago. It's moving from Tallahassee head towards Jacksonville in the eastwardly direction. I mean, they're going up. They got like three major big electrical lines about size of your wrist going in the bottom of these things, and I just wonder if there's something we can do about it, and then just get this thing slowed down or stopped or figured out what's going on with all this, and if there's any EMF dangers to drivers out here, if we're getting radiated with something we need to know about.
You know what? I really don't know. I'm going to do some research on that, though, and see if I can find out what they are, first off, and who's putting them up. You know, are they government? Are they private enterprise? I have no idea, but it's on my list, and I'll go do some research and see what I can figure out. Let's go to Missouri. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin.
What's on your mind today?
Fuel. And it's kind of crappy. I've been doing some... Yeah.
Yeah, it's that time of year.
Yeah, well, not even, I want to say, non-scientific testing. The last week or so, it's been getting it real cold. When I've been fueling up, I've been, pulling a small amount out and holding on to it. I originally started treating the fuel in the tank with some Howes because it was going to get cold. Well, I've been buying my cheapest fuel through Missouri and Illinois on the route that I run every week. So I'm either getting Love's or Pilot fuel where I go. But I treated it with Howes, took a sample out of the tank and compared it to regular fuel, put it in the freezer at home, and they looked about the same, clattered up with somewhere some snotty stuff floating around the bottom. So then this past week,
I do it to you. We're going to have to find out the results of your experiment on the next show, because we ran right into the clock, and when it says I've got to go, then I've got to go. So, but I want to hear the rest of the story. We'll have to do it next time. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Russell. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow for Destination Health.